Let's turn to the book of Deuteronomy once again, chapter 12, picking up in verses 13 to 28. So let me first read the text, and then we'll make comment accordingly. We're continuing now with our third installment, as we've kind of slowed the pace a bit in this particular chapter, considering the God who directs and dictates his worship. When it comes to the corporate worship of God Almighty in a covenantal bond with his people, like under the old economy as well as under the new, God is the one who directs and dictates how that worship is to be done. We are not left to play God when it comes to his worship. Verse 13. Now, as I read this, please pay close attention to what is being said. Take heed to thyself, that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest. So this would apply to when they got into the land, they were to remove what? The high places. They were to remove the groves. They were to remove the idols and the altars that the nations to whom they were about to conquer the land and take the land from. These particular places of worship were dotted all over the land. And what does God tell them? You don't have the right to go around and just worship me wherever you feel like it. But in the place which the Lord shall choose, in one of thy tribes, there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there thou shalt do all that I command thee. So here we see at this time, under the old economy, God is going to prescribe a certain location. Notwithstanding, thou mayest kill and eat flesh in all thy gates, whatsoever thy soul lusteth after, according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he hath given thee, the unclean and the clean may eat thereof, as of the roebuck and as of the hart. Now look at verses 15. It makes mention to unclean and clean. This has no reference to the animals. God made it quite clear that there were clean animals and unclean animals. Certain animals that were designated for food, other animals designated off limits. What he's talking about here are lost people and saved people. God's people versus the strangers who would dwell amongst them. When it came to feasting and eating from the bounty of the land, they were to feast together. Only ye shall not eat the blood, ye shall pour it out upon the earth as water. Thou mayest not eat within thy gate, the gates, the tithe of thy corn, or thy wine, or thy oil, or the firstlings of thy herds, or of thy flock, nor any of thy vows which thou vowest, nor thy freewill offering or heave offering of thy hand. But thou must eat them before the Lord thy God in the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. So notice once again this aspect of the tithe. When they were told to bring the tithe during those cycles of tithing, when they were told on this occasion to bring those tithes to the temple, that what would be the temple complex, then they were to feast upon them before the Lord at the designated location that he would point out. Thou and thy son and thy daughter and thy manservant and thy maidservant and the Levite that is within thy gates, that thou shalt rejoice before the Lord thy God in all that thou puttest thy hands unto. Take heed to thyself, thou forsake not the Levite as long as thou livest upon the earth. So when they brought these tithes to the temple complex, a portion of that was to be given to the Levitical priests, and it was from that giving, it was that free will offering given to the priest by which the Levites made their living, and that's how they were given their sustenance and the ability to, if you will, to be paid for the services that they rendered to God on behalf of the people. When the Lord thy God shall enlarge thy border as he had promised thee, so here it's quite clear that they were going to get the land, okay, And thou shalt say, I will eat flesh, because my soul longeth to eat flesh. Thou mayest eat flesh whatsoever thy soul lusteth after. Now notice this, if the place which the Lord thy God had chosen to put his name there be too far from thee. So during this cycle of tithing, when they were to go to Jerusalem, and not only present their tithes, but to partake of what they were given, if by chance your geographical location was too far from the temple, then thou shalt kill of the herd and of thy flock which the Lord had given thee, as I have commanded thee, and thou shalt eat in thy gates whatsoever thy soul lusteth. Even as the roebuck and the hart is eaten, so shalt thou eat them. The unclean and the clean shall eat of them alike, both the covenantal people and the strangers. Only be sure that thou eat not the blood, for the blood is the life. And thou mayest not eat the life with the flesh. Thou shalt not eat it. Thou shalt pour it upon the earth as water. Thou shalt not eat it, that it may go well with thee and with thy children after thee, when thou shalt do that which is right in the sight of the Lord. Only thy holy things, which thou hast, and thy vows, thou shalt take and go unto the place which the Lord shall choose. And thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and the flesh and the blood upon the altar of the Lord thy God, and the blood of thy sacrifices shall be poured out upon the altar of the Lord thy God, and thou shalt eat the flesh. Observe and hear all these words which I command thee, that it may go well with thee, and with thy children after thee, forever, when thou doest that which is good and right in the sight of the Lord thy God. Well, in this particular portion of Moses' last book, the central theme, again, to this 12th chapter, seems to be the worship of God by his covenantal people as he has prescribed it. God's will was for his people to be a separated people from the pagans that were around them, and more specifically, to be separated from the pagan worship that these nations unfortunately practice. God's worship was not to be one of mixture or one of assimilation with the nations that was around his people. And beloved, that's what normally happens when it comes to the beginning of true religion. Like, if for instance, you take Acts chapter 1. Here you find that infant church of 120 people. And down through the centuries, now we are in the 21st century. What has happened in many respects to the Christian faith? There has been so much mixing and so much assimilation brought into the faith by leaders or by charismatic individuals who have a very strong personality and they'll lead a little group off into little Never Never Land, and they begin to add and modify, subtract and divide the central teachings of the Christian faith, and then it begins to morph into something which is no longer recognizable. This past week or so, I got the next installment of Christian History, and it's talking about Latin American Christianity. Well, I didn't know that Christianity is to be attached to either a particular ethnic group or a particular geographical location. But the article is going to be teaching you the complexity, the mixture, and the assimilation that happened to Christianity amongst the Native Americans once the Spanish got here. Let me read to you one little paragraph that's very interesting. It's a short paragraph. Although many indigenous people adapted to Spanish rule and worked as forced or free laborers on Spanish estates and in Spanish mines, indigenous cultures and religion remain resilient. Some groups and individuals simply resisted Christianization. A few dramatically and violently, others cautiously and secretively. More often, however, people adapted Christian beliefs and practices, but understood them within the indigenous framework. So when you go to parts of, say, the Caribbean, and you will find a picture of the Pope, and you will find statues of Mary and Jesus, Peter and Paul, and then you're going to see all this voodoo paraphernalia on the same table, and the so-called person, this so-called witch doctor or this medicine person who goes around praying over you, drinking whiskey and then spitting it on you and having incense burning, and then he'll take a bunch of branches that are on fire and he'll kind of pat you on top of the head, and that's supposed to exorcise the demons or the demonic forces that are in control of your life at that time. Or maybe some local woman hasn't gotten pregnant yet, and so she'll go to the medicine man, and with his mumbo jumbo, he will incorporate Christianity and the indigenous people religious framework that was there before the Spanish got there, and intertwine all of that and repackage it into a new brand of Christianity. Well, God's people, unfortunately, did the same thing. Let me give you two shocking examples. Turn to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 8. Let me give you a few examples. That by the time of the exile, by the time of the Babylonian exile, remember, the King Nebuchadnezzar on three occasions invades Judea, or Judah, if you will. And on the third and final invasion, that is when he destroys the city and he destroys the first temple built by Solomon. He razes it right to the ground. But what was going on prior to that that would even move God to chasten and to judge his covenant people to that degree? Well, look at verses 7. And he brought me to the door of the court. So Ezekiel is being led by the Spirit of God to the temple court. And when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. Somebody had borne a hole, a peekhole, peekaboo. Then said he unto me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I had digged in the wall, behold, the door. And he said unto me, Go in and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping thing and abominable beast and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. What did they do to the first temple in time? They etched on the wall, in secret, behind a closed door, representations of creeping things. And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients. Okay, this was not a bunch of teenagers having a little fun by sneaking into the temple and carving out some little, you know, treehouse there in the temple. These were aged men. And in the midst of them stood Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Beloved, there was only one designated place to burn incense, and that was at the altar of incense. These 70 men had their own little censer burning their incense in this secret room behind a door. Then said he unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, The Lord seeth us not. The Lord had forsaken the earth. Notice how low and how degrading the worship of God had now become. They had chiseled out a secret room with a door, behind closed, hidden door. They drew on the wall representations of whatever. And now they're burning incense, these 70 men in that one room. And they got the nerve to say, Since we're hiding behind a door, God can't see me. Oh, by the way, God has forsaken us anyway. He said unto me, Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house. So we know that this is the temple, which was towards the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Tammuz. This was supposed to be the incarnated sun god of the Queen of Heaven, who, according to Babylonian mythology, was violently killed, buried, and rose from the dead. And the women would weep for him, get this, 40 days of weeping. 40 days of weeping for Tammuz, you get 40 days of Lent and self-deprivation until Christ would rise from the grave. Then said he unto me, Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. And he brought me unto the inner court of the Lord's house. Beloved, now you're on the inside. And behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Lord and their faces towards the east. And they worshiped the sun towards the east. It would seem that by the time Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Daniel were walking this earth, that the worship that was conducted in the temple had really denigrated to where God is telling Ezekiel, you want to see some more what they're doing? Greater abominations in the plural? Again, this is not figurative. You can't take this figuratively. This is literally what the people were doing. Want to see another example? Turn to the 22nd chapter of the same book. So you see, one of the reasons why God was moved to banish his people from off the land and to destroy city and temple. Ezekiel 22. Look at verses 25 to 26. Look at this. There is a conspiracy of her prophets in the midst thereof, like a roaring lion ravening the prey. They have devoured souls. They have taken the treasure and precious things. They have made her many widows in the midst thereof. Her priests have violated my law and have profaned my holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and profane. Neither have they shown difference between unclean and the clean, and have hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them. What do we see here in these two very sad portions of Ezekiel? We see God's people in time mixing, blending, modifying, and assimilating into the true worship of the true and living God, practices of the nations that were around them. They brought them into the temple complex and they practiced them, some in secret, some in the open. But what was their thought in their mind? God doesn't see us. And by the way, what all the invasions by the Babylonians, he's forsaken us anyway. So why even care? Why even bother? What about the contemporary church today, like in America? How much assimilation has the church done with worldly practices and worldly means and worldly innovations? I find it amazing that the world is not imitating the church in that regards, but we find many churches imitating and assimilating the tactics and the mindset of the world to build a church. They will bring in entertainment. They'll have lots of music to draw the crowd. It may be a few minutes of God's word, and then they send everybody home cheerful and happy. Sin is no longer preached against. Sin's not even defined. In some circles, there's no need to bring a Bible because they don't even believe the Bible to be God's word, let alone if they have a Bible, they seldom read it out loud or read it in a public format. So what's going on with the American churches? Something apparently very similar that was going on in the days of Ezekiel. And now we have this great push for female pastors and elders. We have this push now against the church to recognize the alternate lifestyle, the gay, lesbian, transgender, whatever alphabet letters you want to use, lifestyle. We have to bring that into the church. We have to tolerate that and bring it into the church and somehow put even that into the blender. And then we'll add Christ into all of that mix. Thus, they were not to imitate, mix, blend, or switch pagan rites and pagan practices into the worship of God. But they were to remove, destroy, and tear down the altars, the groves, and the high places. Thus, God expected his people to guard their worship of the true and the living God. However, as one reads, now let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 12. One reads Deuteronomy chapter 12, 8 through 11. God is giving new instructions as the wanderings would be replaced with a permanent settlement. Let's look at that again. Look at verses 8. Ye shall not do after all the things that we do here this day, comma, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. Apparently, that was the mindset during the wandering period, those 40 years of wandering. Moses was constantly trying to keep the people in check. Constantly, they were murmuring against his leadership. Constantly chiding with him over their external situations and their predicament that was attached to their wanderings. Not enough water, not enough food. Moses, you take too much upon yourself. Even his own brother and sister chided him in his position of authority. Who made you the boss? Who died and made you king of the universe? Read on. For ye are not as yet come to the rest and to the inheritance which the Lord your God giveth you. But when ye go over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about, verses 10 sounds like they're going to cash in and get all the land so that you dwell in safety. Keep on watching. Then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall ye bring all that I command you. So verses 8, Moses is telling the second generation of Israelites that were born and groomed and nurtured and matured in that 40-year wilderness trek. Transition time is coming. You are no longer, when it comes to worship, you are no longer going to do whatever you think ought to be done. Not as every man pleases. Once we get into land, we're no longer going to be wandering. We're going to become a permanent nation and a permanent settlement in all the land that God swore. And once we reach that new plateau in our covenantal journey, then God is going to designate a certain location. And there only will the worship of the Most High be done. Well, evidentially, as I just read, an established location would be made. And thus the temple complex, okay, is being hinted at here. And all you got to do, you don't need to turn there, but read 1 Kings chapter 8. There you will find the completion of the temple and Solomon's dedication of the temple. Now look at verses 15 of chapter 12. Notwithstanding, thou mayest kill and eat flesh in all thy gates. Now there's that third year of this so-called tithing cycle. Whatsoever thy soul lusteth after, according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he had given thee, the unclean and the clean may eat thereof, and the, as of the roebuck and as of the hart. Only ye shall not eat the blood, ye shall pour it upon the earth as water. Well, beloved, it talks about the clean and the unclean that is mentioned here. And at first glance, many people will read that and they're thinking, is God changing his mind? On the surface, it would seem to sound as if God now has lifted the restriction on the dietary requirements. That's how some people would actually read that. But can I go someplace in this book to find the definition? Watch this. Turn to the 15th chapter. And notice verses 22. Thou shalt eat it within thy gates. The unclean and the clean person shall eat it alike, as the roebuck and as the hart. Only thou shalt not eat the blood thereof. Thou shalt pour it upon the ground as water. So there you go. Notice how the Bible is its own dictionary. And the translators who were doing the translation work, if you notice, those words are in the italics, which means it's not in the Hebrew text that which undergirds the translation, but the implication is there based on the context. So when God says the clean and the unclean can eat or may eat, he's not referring to the animals, that God somehow is going to lift the dietary restrictions. They're there. But I found it amazing. Once again, those today who simply champion the 10% of everyone's income off the top has to come to the church. And if you don't go, and if you don't give, God's going to let the car engine blow up. One of you is going to break a leg, and God's going to beat you with his stick. I find that to be a very disastrous motivator, whether you're giving 10% or whether you're giving a dollar. What do we do with this cycle? When was the last time a bunch of elders in the church got up and said, we had a pretty good offering last Sunday, and at the end of services, we have a feast downstairs, courtesy of the church? That would seem to be a parallel application to what the Israelites were allowed to do on the third year of that cycle. And when was the last time any congregation, to your reckoning, said, since we had a good offering this past Sunday, we're going to take a portion of that and we're going to open up a soup kitchen as an extension of our church ministry, and out of that tithing that you all give, we're going to have this soup kitchen and try to provide some hot meals and some snacks, bottled water, whatever, maybe some clothes if we can afford it, especially during the summertime with the heat, and in the winter with the cold, provide coats and jackets. When's the last time you saw that? In many instances, that money stays right in the church to take care of the overhead, which I don't knock. But I'm just saying, if you're going to look to the Old Testament and say, you got to give 10%, if not, God's going to get you. Notice what God gave allowances to on these days of cycle, on these cycles of tithing. All you hear is the crickets. But you better give your 10%, if not, God's going to get you. Now, did you notice something? Look at verse 16. Excuse me. Only ye shall not eat the blood, but you are to take the blood and pour it on the ground. Right? You are to pour it upon the ground. Look at verse 24. Thou shalt not eat it. Thou shalt pour it upon the earth as water. So notice this stipulation that was ingrained into the minds of God's people. They were not to eat or drink the blood, but it was to be poured out. Now, take that, and let's go all the way back to the Council of Jerusalem, Acts 15. You ever wonder why James said what he said? I find this interesting. In the Old Testament, they weren't to eat it or to drink it. They were to simply pour it on the ground as if it was water. Look at Acts chapter 15, verse 19. This is James, the half-brother of Jesus. He makes the final judgment, if you will, in regards to everything that was said on that particular day about the Gentiles coming into the church. Wherefore my sentence, or my judgment, or my decision is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God. James says the troubling of the Gentile community is to stop because of the Judaizers. is going to come to an end. But that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols, from fornication, from things strangled, and notice, and from blood. Well, why did James say that? Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 12, you find God making a reference to the fact you do not eat, you do not drink the blood, you pour it upon the ground. Now, why is James tacking on verses 20? I thought the intent of this letter was to relieve the tension and the trouble caused by the Judaizers. Is James backpedaling here on the decision of the council? No. Read on. For Moses of old time hath in every city them that preach him. James is referring to his Jewish brothers and sisters in the flesh. And what? Being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day. Then pleased it the apostles and elders with the whole church to send chosen men of their own company to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, namely Justus, surnamed Barsabas, and Silas, chief men among the brethren. Why is James adding that verse 20? Why is he tacking on those restrictions? For the sake of the conscience of the Jewish, lost Jewish men and women who are scattered across the Roman Empire, whom the church would eventually come in contact with the gospel, and not to be an offense to the Jewish community. James says, for the sake of peace, for the sake of getting along, and for the sake of tranquility, and to minimize any undue offense to the gospel and to the cross, we require that you do these things for the sake of the Jews who are sprinkled and scattered throughout the Roman Empire. Now, let's go back to Deuteronomy 12, verses 17-19. We hear so much again about giving 10% to the church, but when was the last time a pastor explained all these facts related to this cycle of tithing? It would seem once in the land, and once the temple complex was up and functioning, a certain designated tithe was to be consumed by the people in a celebratory fashion, with an important requirement to take care of God's priests. Look at verse 19. Take heed to thyself, and thou forsake not the Levite, as long as thou livest upon the earth. Turn to chapter 14, same book. Excuse me. Look at verse 27. Chapter 14, look at verses 27. And the Levite that is within thy gates, thou shalt not forsake him, for he has no part nor inheritance with thee. So yes, under the old economy, that tithe that was brought into the temple complex, a portion of that was distributed amongst the Levitical priests. That was, in essence, their paycheck. That was their payment for the service of God that they rendered on behalf of the people to God, and God on behalf to the people. And so there, beloved, I have no problem when a congregation taking care of its elders and its pastors, beloved. There is to be, the church is to be very, very mindful of that. Now, while on the same subject here, look at Deuteronomy chapter 14 again, and look at verses 28. Excuse me. Look at 14, 28. Notice these words, Deuteronomy 14. Look at verse 28. What do you do with this? At the end of 3 years, thou shalt bring forth all the tithe of thy increase, the same year, and thou shalt lay it up within thy gates. Ooh, I thought it was supposed to go to the house of God. And the Levite, because he had no part nor inheritance with thee, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow, which are within thy gates, shall come, and shall eat and be satisfied, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thy hand which thou doest.
Now, for many years, I used to read that, and many years you go to church after church after church, and you have this pressure upon you. Did you give? Did you give your 10%? And if you don't give your 10%, God's going to get you. I've heard that. That's a real motivator to give. You know, that a lightning bolt is going to make you into a French fry because you didn't give 10%. How do you handle verses 28 and 29 in the contemporary church? At the end of the third year, that tithe stayed with you. And that bounty was to be distributed to the fatherless, the widow, the homeless, and above all, the Levites that were in your community. Don't find too many churches want to let loose those purse strings. When was the last time any local church designated a time of food and drink with festival from the church coffers? It would seem many who are more concerned about income have overlooked other ways the tithe was to be used under the old economy. It was more than just giving 10%. It would seem the ancient storehouse was to benefit a much wider group of recipients. These directives didn't come from a denominational headquarters, nor did it come from a board of elders, deacons, but from heaven itself. Now look at verses 20. Go back to Deuteronomy 12:20. When the Lord thy God shall enlarge thy border as he had promised thee, and thou shalt say, I will eat flesh because my soul longeth to eat flesh. Thou mayest eat flesh whatsoever thy soul desireth or lusteth after. If the place which the Lord thy God had chosen to put his name be too far from thee, then thou shalt kill of thy herd and of thy flock which the Lord had given thee, as I have commanded thee, and thou shalt eat in thy gates whatsoever thy soul desireth or lusteth after, even as the roebuck and the hart is eaten. So thou shalt eat them. The unclean and the clean shall eat of them alike, both the Israelite and the stranger. Only be sure that thou eat not the blood, for the blood is the life. Thou mayest not eat of it, because it's the life of the flesh. Thou shalt not eat of it, but thou shalt pour it upon the earth as water. Thou shalt not eat it, that it may go well with thee and with thy children after thee, when thou shalt do that which is right. Notice, in comparison to verse 8, which is right in God's sight. What does verses 8 say? Transition time's coming. We're no longer going to do whatsoever you think is right. Look at that verse 8 and then compare it to the ending to verse 25. There was a time when all you guys out there during this 40 years of wandering and complaining and griping and chiding and challenging and resisting God's will, resisting his leadership, that's all going to come to an end, buddy. We're no longer going to do it your way. We got to do it that which is right. No, notice, in the sight of God. So a stipulation given to a distance is also pointed out here. If you live way up there near the Euphrates River, and God required you to be in Jerusalem at a set time, at this point, when it came to giving the state a tithe, this is not those feast days, but when it came to giving a tithe to the temple complex that God required, if you were geographically too far, you took that tithe and you benefited the community in which you lived. I found it amazing as we don't find churches today saying, let's have a feast on the church. Then look at verses 26. Only thy holy things which thou hast and thy vows thou shalt take and go unto the place which the Lord shall choose. Okay, once they were done feasting, right, they're not going to be carrying all of this load. Now they're carrying much more lighter load. Now they can go. And thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and the flesh of the blood upon the altar of the Lord thy God, and the blood of thy sacrifices shall be poured out upon the altar of the Lord thy God, and thou shalt eat the flesh. Observe and hear all these words which I command thee, that it may go well with thee and with thy children after thee forever, when thou doest that which is good and right in the sight of the Lord thy God. So notice, as I close out this portion of chapter 12, when it comes to worship, it is not an issue of me doing my own thing in a corporate covenantal body. The question is, what the church is doing, is it honorable and pleasing and acceptable in the sight of God and God only? Well, may the Lord choose to bless his word.
Amen.